there's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
And we are live and on time, even though I give Ken Berry hell all the time about showing up on time. He actually does. He's in the green room. We will have him on in just a moment. We're going to talk about the proper human diet today. We're going to talk about the American Diabetes Society. Well, that's been around a long time, hasn't it? No, you're thinking of the American Diabetes Association. That's the one that attempts to kill you with recipes that are supposed to help support your diabetes and your kidneys in partnership with my friends at DaVita. Like, we're going to go the opposite way and actually talk about fixing this problem today. This is a huge survival topic because the first rule of survival is wake up alive tomorrow. And if you die, you failed the freaking test. So we'll have Ken on in just a minute. Before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today, perfect for Ken Berry, Anton's Land of Biltong. I get every 2 weeks a box in the mail that contains, and I didn't eat it all this time. It came a day early because of the holiday. Biltong, this is Angus Biltong. I also get Wagyu Biltong. And then my favorite right here, Dewars. These are a type of dry sausage. These are awesome. I actually get to eat Dewars and Biltong while Ken talks today, and he has to suffer through it and not get any. But you can get yours. Just go to antonslandofbiltong.com. You can buy one off. You can put a package together, whatever. Or you can subscribe and get a shipment every 2 weeks, every month, whatever does it for you. Check it out. Life is too short for average. And Anton's Biltong, and I am a Biltong connoisseur, is some of the best that I have ever had. Next up today, John Pugliano with the Wealth Studying Podcast, where you can learn to grow your wealth the way that you grow your garden in your homestead. And John is one of us. He's not just some, you know, guy that's out there talking about money that doesn't really know what he's doing. John became a liquid millionaire before he managed $1 of client money. He is also a ham radio operator. He is a prepper. He is a good dude. He's been on our expert council since 2010. I've been working with him since then when I met him originally in Salt Lake City at a prepper convention. And he has a great podcast. Again, the Wealth Studying Podcast. Comes out about once a week. It'll be 8 to 15 minutes long. Get his insights into what's going on with the economy, because that is also a huge survival topic. And with that, I want to bring our special guest on, Ken Berry. Ken, welcome to the show, bro.
Hey, Jack, my friend. Good to be with you again.
So if somebody's been under a rock, doesn't know that you answer expert counsel questions, you know, when you get to them, but you answer expert counsel, seriously, you answer a ton. I'll get like a flood of them at once. You've been around working with us like John for a long time as a council member. You've got like 2 million YouTube subs or something like that. But there are actually people who don't know who or what a Ken Berry is. So yep. Who are you, Ken, and how did you end up in this world of trying to save people through diet?
So I am a family physician. I've been practicing family medicine for over 22 years now. And early in my career as a doctor, I became severely obese and pre-diabetic. And in my personal quest to fix that, because much like Texas, Tennesseans are very common sense people. And so if you take your car to a mechanic to fix it and there's all kinds of junkers in his front yard that won't run, you're like, maybe I shouldn't take my car to this guy, right? A fat doctor doesn't go over well in Tennessee. People, when I say, okay, Chuck, you need to lose some weight, Chuck looks down at the button over my belly button like, oh, I do? Okay, I'll work on that, Doc. Thanks for that. So I had to fix that. I couldn't be that guy. So in my quest to fix that, I have rediscovered, along with many other people, what I consider to be a proper human diet. And I've been following Jack Spearco since he was in the Jetta.
That's a while.
A long time. I used to go upstairs at lunch and listen to the survival podcast in between seeing patients. I would eat my lunch and listen to this crazy guy right here because I was all interested in growing as many fruits and vegetables as I could on my, at that time, little 14 acre farm I'd bought. And so I have kiwi in my yard because of Jack Spearco. I have jujube trees in my yard because of Jack Spearco. I've got purslane planted everywhere because of Jack Spearco. Okay. And so, I reached out to him when I wrote the book, Lies My Doctor Told Me. And I was like, he was like, who is this punk? I don't even know who this guy is. And so I finally talked him into letting me be on, and we actually got into it because he's like, you can't tell me that plants are a problem. They're bad. I'm like, well, actually, and then I bet him a grand that he couldn't gain weight eating nothing but beef, butter, bacon, and eggs. And that really pissed him off. And then he tried it, and he lost weight eating as much as he could possibly hold. He's like, shit, okay, maybe this guy knows something.
I'll let the slight embellishment go.
I'm not conflating, right? That's all true, right?
I say I'll let the slight embellishment there go. I've always been a proponent of low carb. Yeah. What I wasn't was an adherent to it for a yeah. lot of years. And I did, as Ken said, I lost about 80 pounds going full on keto. And what I had done, and this is reality, like I was never big into lots of carbs. But what happened is you fall off because I wasn't keto. I wasn't going high enough in the fat, so you don't get the satiation.
Right.
And so what would happen is I would do like kind of an Atkins or Eads style diet, and I'd lose a bunch of weight.
Yep.
And then I would put it right back on. And I never blamed the diet because I was people say, well, you put the weight back on. Well, when I started eating crap again, I put the weight back on. But what I found is when you go into things that are like high in fat as well, and you go, I'm not carnivore like Ken is. I'm like 90% carnivore. I still eat peppers, just cilantro, herbs, things like that, you know. But when I went to where, like, I'm getting 60 to 80% of my diet calories from fat, like, this is literally the first thing I've eaten today.
Yep, exactly. And I haven't eaten
at 12:30.
It's 12:30 here. I haven't eaten yet. And when I get done, I'm going to go work on the farm. I'll probably come in and eat at 4.
The only reason I'm eating is to torture you anyway. And
I know,
because it's the sponsor of the day.
I know. but now I've actually talked to Dorothy about this, and Jack losing the 80 pounds and eating a proper human diet has not made him any prettier, but it has made him sexier. So there's that.
I started this show audio only because I have a face and a voice made for radio. Seriously, let's kind of dig into this.
Yeah.
Can you describe what you mean by the proper human diet and how that differs from what people call a Western diet, or I like to call it a SAD diet, a standard American diet?
Yeah, so nutrition research has been thoroughly and completely captured by the big food corporations. And so they use two things to trick you. One is they'll fund a study trying to show that their particular product, it could be almonds, it could be pomegranate juice, it could be a particular breakfast cereal or a bar or a shake. They'll fund that research and the researchers will give them a result that's like, oh yes, look, this does something to improve your health. But the second way they learn from the big tobacco manufacturers is they introduce confusion into the discussion. So they'll be like, well, actually, there's a study that shows that, you know, if you eat standard highly processed American diet, it actually improves this metric. And so therefore, we think all this is wrong. And so they just confuse everybody. And the average person who's going to go to the supermarket and buy food, they don't have time for all that crap. They're just like, this is all, like, you know, you remember, oh, butter's bad. Oh, butter's good. Oh, butter's bad. Eggs are bad. Eggs are good. Bacon will kill you. No, eat one piece a day. It's just like, finally, you're like, screw it. I'm going to eat what I want. That's exactly what the big food manufacturers want you to say. They want you to give up and say, this is stupid. I'm not even listening to any of this, because they know you'll wind up eating the Lucky Charms if you do that. And that's the goal. And so a proper human diet that I've rediscovered is going to help you get very close to your ideal body weight. Going to help you have a normal A1C. It's going to help you have a normal fasting insulin. It's going to help you have a normal triglyceride, normal HDL cholesterol, normal CRP. It's going to help you have a normal waist to height ratio or very close to it. Those are the measurable criteria. If a diet that you're eating is not giving you those numbers, either within normal limits or very close, your diet is improper to the degree with which you're not hitting those numbers. Okay, so that's the black and white way you can measure this.
You know, I've had talks with people about the numbers, and I'm not big on spending a lot of time at the doctor's office. I'm really not.
Sure.
But the basic tests like A1C and fasting insulin and all these other tests, when I've had people tell me, well, I went carnivore or whatever, and they say I didn't lose a ton of weight, but then you look at them and you go, well, you didn't really need to.
Right.
Because I've seen people that, you know, like you got a woman that's 5'2" and 220 pounds. And I'm sorry, I'm not being fat shaming. You are not freaking healthy. Right. 100%. That is outside the bounds of anything approaching health. And I've seen them lose weight, like just firestorm lose weight. But then you see this person and they're like, you know, they're 5'11 and 205 and they go on a carnivore diet and they end up 196. And it's like, dude, check your numbers, because that's how that person needs to be judging their progress.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so in my opinion, a proper human diet is low in carbohydrates by design. Whether that turns out to be Atkins or low carb or paleo or primal, that for many people, that's their proper human diet. Eating under 100 total grams of carbohydrates a day, predominantly coming from naturally occurring carbohydrates. For many people, that's all they need to do. For the really 80% of people, if you cut out all added sugar, all grains, wheat, rice, oats, corn, soybean, millet, amaranth, rye, and cut out all the vegetable seed oils. For 80% of the population, you're immediately going to start to lose fat and get healthier.
So I've always wanted to ask you this. You've said this, and it's true. You and I, if we look at a carbohydrate,
yes,
we start putting weight back on. We don't have to eat it. We can look at it, be in the same room as a basket of French fries,
yep,
and we start swelling up.
Yep.
What is it biochemically or, that causes people like us? I'm an O blood type. I've heard that theory. I think there might be something to it, but I don't know. But maybe. You and I both, we can't do the 100 carbs a day. 100 carbs a day is like 300 carbs for the average person for us.
Yes. And so there is a normal distribution curve for everything in biology.
Okay.
Everything. Every mammal, every animal, every human, there's a normal variation. For most people, if they just cut the carbs under 100 a day, they're going to hit the best health they've had in decades.
Okay.
Some people have to cut it down to under 50 a day. Some people have to cut it under 20, some under 10. And people like me and you, we have to be as close to zero carb as we can and stay there to reach close to our ideal body weight. And it's just the normal variation. It's probably mostly genetic, most likely. Where your people come from. You and I are both northern latitude DNA.
Yeah.
Scotch, Irish, Nordic, Neanderthal, we got lots of that.
Yeah.
Some people, you know, if your ancestors have lived on the equator for the last 25,000 years, you're probably not going to fatten nearly as easy. If you're Asian, for some Asian people, you literally could hook them up to an IV of Ding Dong's Pepsi Cola and McDonald's fries. And they might get a little belly pooch, but they're not going to get just round obese like you and I could.
Yeah, yeah. They're never going to get bye-bye arms where the arm waves goodbye.
That's right. That they're just not built for that. They don't hold fat like that. But they will get severely hyperinsulinemic, severely inflamed, severely type 2 diabetic, and they'll have severe visceral adiposity, which is fat in your gut. They'll have that belly pooch. And if you've ever been to anywhere on the Asian continent, you'll see that any man over age of 40 has got a little belly pooch.
Mm-hmm.
He probably has either prediabetes or type 2 diabetes, but to the Western white boy eye, he looks pretty healthy. But until you check his numbers, and then you're like, oh crap, this guy, he's half dead, but he doesn't look half dead to us because he doesn't fatten like we do. So a proper human diet is low in carbohydrates. A proper human diet is uninflammatory. A proper human diet consists of foods that are ancestrally appropriate. And what I mean by that is foods that humans would have had ready access to.
Agreed.
More than 12,000 years ago. Whatever happened 10 to 12,000 years ago, something happened. Was it a asteroid? Was it a bunch of volcanic eruptions? Was it just a shift in the global climate? I don't think we know for sure, but we know that about 10, 12,000 years ago, all these megafauna, which is an animal that weighs over 100 pounds, they all went extinct. And I think mankind played a big role in that, hunting them, because, you know, an elephant, their gestational period, they're pregnant for 18 months before they have a baby. And then it takes years before that baby's able to reproduce. So if you've got a bunch of annoying humans around with their little spears and their rocks and shit, and you kill the bull of that tribe, that's it. They're done. They're not going to reproduce, right? Because
I think that had some impact, But I don't think it's what wiped out the megafauna, and this is why.
Agreed.
Drive across this country and see how much nothing there is. Now, let's go back 10,000 years during the Younger Dryas, and you get an atlatl and a spear and a bunch of your buddies, and you're going to kill every woolly mammoth. You're going to kill every giant camel. You're going to kill every giant sloth. Like, I don't think that you can set foot on every square mile of the freaking continent over 5,000 years in that situation. So I think we did impact what was left, and maybe because we did have a cataclysm. We do know that down to Pennsylvania and New York and New Jersey, we had ice sheets that were 2 miles thick during the Younger Dryas.
Yep.
The coastline of the Atlantic coast was 250 miles out to sea from where it is now.
Yep.
So I think all that came together. And I think what might have happened is massive migration patterns, and that made those animals more susceptible to being picked off. But, yeah, I agree with you. Something went wrong, and I think it was modern agriculture. Because wheat. Go eat wheat without somebody preparing it for you. It will choke you to death. Because I'm very much with you. If you can't pick it up off the ground and eat it, right? And maybe it's dirty and you should wash it or whatever, but you can eat meat raw.
Yep.
Right? I'm not saying you should. I'm just saying you can.
Yes.
But you go try to eat wheat in its raw form and it will flat. You'll choke to death before you even get it down.
Right. And then you also have the shits for a week after that because you just can't. You can't. You cannot digest that. I think modern agriculture was humanity's response to whatever we were starving. We were starving. And the way I understand anthropology and archaeology is basically a response. It was a last grasp effort for us to keep from starving to death and becoming extinct ourselves, because I saw in the comments, yes, humans are megafauna.
Yes.
Also, there was a lot of cannibalism going on during that time as well, because there was nothing to eat. Archaeologists don't like to talk about that. That's often left unsaid. But yeah, if you look at the stable isotope analysis, there was a lot of cannibalism. Because you will feed your neighbor to your kids before you let your kids starve. All of us will do that. I can say things like that on Jack's show because I know all you guys are common sense. People are like, I would totally eat the neighbor if I was going to starve. Sorry, neighbor, but, hopefully we never get in that situation. But, yes, we were like, we're going to starve. There's no animals. And so the megafauna are different than smaller animals. Typically, smaller animals have a bigger litter. They have a much shorter gestational period. And we can see evidence in archaeology of this. The Australians have tried for years to kill off the feral cats or to get rid of the rabbits or to get rid of this. You literally cannot do it. If you enlisted everybody in the country, you cannot wipe them out. But when a huge animal only has one offspring at a time, maybe twins sometimes, but usually one, their gestation is 18 months. And it also takes that offspring when it's born. It takes it years before it's sexually mature. It's much easier to put them in danger, right? And so I think we did play a role in that. So uninflammatory, low in carbohydrates, ancestrally appropriate. It helps you achieve those normal numbers that I talked about earlier. It is never ultra processed. By definition, it's not ultra processed. Often it's unprocessed. And a lot of people have trouble with this word, process, Jack. Anything you do to food before you eat it is processing. Yes, absolutely. That's why we have to say ultra processed. So when if you are driving and you see a deer get walloped by a truck and you take that deer home and you cut it up, that's processing. Yes, 100%.
That's literally what you call it. Processing.
That's right. You process the deer. That's right. But processing is not the problem. Cooking is processing. We've been doing that for a million years. We've been cutting. There's evidence millions of years ago. And there's some new finds recently, like a stupid amount of millions of years ago. There's cut marks on bones of animals, like a long day. Like, damn, we were really going at it a long time ago before we were even human. And I'm sorry to my young earth creationist friends. I love you guys. I grew up young earth creationist. I'm sorry. I love you, but that's all I can say is I love
you're
you.
You're free to believe whatever you want, but you're not free to make us believe it with you.
No, exactly. We've been cooking food for somewhere between 800,000 to a million years.
Did you see the mammoth bones that they found in California? That were not millions of years, but it was like 125,000 years old.
Yep.
With perfect... straight line cuts into the femur bones.
Yep.
Carbonated, sir, peer-reviewed, verified. This shit's 125,000 years old, which means we had humans in North America at least that long ago, because ain't nothing else in nature can do that.
Nothing can do that. Nothing would ever do that. That's exactly right. And there's no accident. There's no erosion. There's no nothing you can play. That had to be human beings or one of our predecessors. Could have been an offspring, some that got over here. But, I mean, we're going to effectively, everything you think you know about human migration onto the North American continent is completely, totally wrong.
Well, now, I think of the ice bridge being like this ice thing, but that whole corridor from Siberia into the United States during the period they say people came over was open in green valleys.
Yes.
It was weird. It's like frozen on both sides in this open green corridor. At least
I'm sure some of us did come through that corridor.
Yes.
There were humanoids here using tools to process animals way before that. Now, who they were, what they were doing, how they got here, I don't know. I don't think anybody does. But they were here, and they were doing their tricks a long time ago.
And your comments on the megafauna are interesting, too, because what you're talking about is like R strategist versus K strategist organisms, right? So an R strategist reproduces quickly in large numbers, and their strategy for survival is to make as many of themselves as possible. It's like all bacteria are R strategist, but some are more than others, right?
Right.
And then a K-strategist, we're a K-strategist.
Yeah.
Our survival strategy is to provide so much protection during the developmental stage of our offspring that they're well adapted to carry on the species.
Yes.
Right. So an elephant works in that model. A rabbit works in a K-strategist or an R-strategist model.
Yep.
And that's a very keen observation. And I think there's something, too, because I think even though like a lot of our megafauna did survive in North America, bison, elk, deer, who the hell knows what their numbers were?
Oh, had to
right.
Be
how tight was the bottleneck for those critters during that? We don't really know.
Nope. And we may never know, and we don't need to know, because here's the thing about a proper human diet. There's about 13 principles. I don't want to go into all of them, but anybody can get a free copy of my proper human proper human diet guidebook off of any of my YouTube videos. There's a link in the show notes. You can get it for free. I'll email it to you. But here's the way you know. What I'm recommending, Jack, is not some weird synthetic pharmaceutical that you've got to take or some weird supplement. I'm just saying eat the following things and don't eat the following things and do that for 90 days and see what happens to your waistline, see what happens to your A1C. And so there may be a small subset of people who get sick doing this. If so, don't do this. It's not like I'm recommending some weird chemical substance.
Yeah.
I'm just saying eat the following foods, and here's my rationale for that. If you don't want to do that, that's fine. If you think that, no, ancient einkorn wheat, that is fine. Well, I've got evidence to the contrary, but if you want to eat that, that's fine. Do that. But when you really dig into anthropology, archaeology, paleoanthropology, what you find is that grains and beans are great starvation foods. They're great fallback foods. They're poverty foods.
Yep.
If you can't get anything else, eat all the beans and rice. 100%. Yes, they will keep you from starving. But if what you're looking to do is optimize your health, there's no place for that kind of food. And if you eat too much of it, in fact, you will actually harm your health.
Well, I think that like kind of your overall theory that agriculture was something we came to by necessity. I think it's necessity. I also think it's a great way to control people.
100%.
It's a great way to establish a state and a pharaoh or a king to watch over the grain storage. It's a way to commoditize food. Because if you think about it this way, if we all lived in a place right now, you've been to my place. I haven't been to your place, but I kind of know what it's like. Like animals run around here. Like if I want to eat something, I have deer feeding in my east pasture and my west pasture. I can just go out, pop food. Like if you have food available like that, and you think that it makes sense to plant corn and beans and rice, I'll tell you what you've never done. You've never planted corns and beans and rice, especially in the technological state we were in, not 10,000 years ago, but 200 years ago. Because anybody that's even run, I know you have a small garden, you run a small garden, you're like, this is a lot of freaking work.
Yep.
Where you bring down a bison and the village eats for a week.
That's right.
Right? And you said survival food. I think this lends credence to the fat. When you look at indigenous people, when they take down a large animal like that, what's the first thing they eat? The organs?
Yep.
And the fat. The best job you could have in the heyday of safaris in Africa, where they had these big, you know, like a rich guy like you would go over there and hunt for 2 months and live out of the camp, the best job was the skinner. You'd think it'd be something like the gun bearer or the guide's assistant. No, it was the skinner, because the skinner got to the animal first. And I read this in like Hemingway's books, Robert Rourke's books, Peter Capstick's books. The first thing those guys did is that fat that's inside, like the stuff around the kidneys and in here, they would take that fat out. And that was like their bonus.
Yep.
That they got, because they're lean, you know, antelope or lean, et cetera, like an elephant, sure. But like an antelope or a gazelle, lean animal, not a lot of fat. And that was like gold to those guys.
Yep. The fat around the kidneys, the fat around the eyeballs, that was the most prized morsel of any kill. And so I guess you'd want to be the skinner. That makes good sense, because you get first dibs. Nobody would ever know.
Yep.
No, that's part of the process. Don't worry about that.
Don't worry about it. And then you could sell it on the side, man, if you need some, because you got plenty, right? Yep. You know? What have you identified as far as the significant problems with modern diets? Can you, like, as a, you've worked as a practicing physician, you've spent most of your time in the last five or more years, like, doing public outreach, but you still actually consult with people. What are the biggest problems you see happening to our health from eating the food? And let's leave out Cheetos and Hostess Twinkies, right?
Sure.
The stuff they actually tell us that we're supposed to eat. You know, base our diet on bread and grains, eat lots of fruits and vegetables, get tablets from Fox News because you can't eat enough fruits and vegetables.
Right.
That diet, what does it do to people?
So it does exactly the same thing as if you just lived on Ding Dongs and Cheetos and Pepsi Cola, but it doesn't do it as quickly. It doesn't do it as severely. The biggest problem with the standard American diet is people are confused and misled. And so very often they'll make what I call a false choice, or they'll arrive at a false solution. So when the guy who's living on Ding Dongs and Cheetos and Pepsi Cola has a chest pain or has a little heart attack, has something happen, he's like, oh shit, I got to stop this. I got to get healthy. So this guy goes to his doctor. His doc's like, oh, you need to eat a plant-based diet, which he was already eating a plant-based diet. It's 100% plants, right? But he's like, you got to eat plant-based, or you got to eat Mediterranean, which they mean 95% plant-based by that. And this guy goes out and he buys a bunch of whole grain bread. He starts making fruit juice smoothies, and he starts eating all the fruit and vegetables. You know he's going to eat way more fruit. And he starts eating all these healthy things. And then he either gets a little bit healthier or none at all. At that point, what's that? Because he really spent a lot of effort. He spent a lot of money. He went to Whole Foods and bought all the organic non-GMO stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't really move the needle. Common sense people want you to give them advice that when they apply it, they can tell a difference, whether financially, whether on the farm, whether for nutrition. You want, when I say do the following things and stop doing the following things, if you don't get a signal back from your belt loop or from your waistline or from your health, your mental clarity, you're going to be like, well, hell, that didn't help. And you're going to throw that as the wayside and you'll be like, that didn't help me. Most people, after they've tried that two or three times, you know, they were told, I used to tell people, join Weight Watchers and join the gym. That's all you got to do. That's it. Back in 2003, that would have been my advice to you, as ignorant as that advice is. Right?
Yeah.
A lot of docs today are giving ignorant advice. Eat a plant-based diet. Okay, well, what does that mean? Well, you go and you eat a lot of bread, a lot of fruit. And then, you know, you can, I mean, McDonald's has, if you eat their fries, that's plant-based.
Yeah. No, I say that plant-based, when they say plant-based, if your diet is made up of 51% of your calories coming from plants, it's plant-based because that's the dominant source of your calories.
Right.
I know they mean go vegetarian or whatever.
Yeah.
But to me, if I'm getting 60% of my calories from bread, pasta, potato, right, I'm eating a plant-based diet, and I think America's very sick because of it.
And you can get fat as a dog tick on a plant-based diet. Yeah. If you go to McDonald's and order the super value meal and you take the two little slivers of meat out of the Big Mac.
Yeah.
And eat all the fries, drink the Coke, and eat the entire sandwich without the meat, that's a vegan diet.
At least vegetarian. Who the hell knows
what they're going to kick back and say, well, that's not what they mean. Well, then what the hell do they
mean? What the hell do they mean then?
What do they mean? Exactly. Hold your doctor's feet to the fire. Say, well, what do you mean then, doctor?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, eat lots of what? Broccoli? Okay. whole wheat grain. Okay. Am I going to be able to get enough nutrition doing that? Am I going to have to eat three meals a day with snacks in between and still be hungry? Do it? Yes, you are. So you're telling me basically to eat constantly like a gorilla has to, or to graze constantly like herbivores in the wild, have to literally eat for 18 hours a day, and I'm still going to have to take a handful of supplements.
Yeah.
You're telling me that's a proper human diet?
Don't you find that, what is it, balance of nature, where they literally say you can't eat enough fruits and vegetables to get the nutrients you need to get from fruits and vegetables, to be like, well, hold on.
Right.
Wait a minute. If that's true, then is that what we're supposed to eat? Because what I'd like you maybe to speak on is a little bit about the difference in digestive systems.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, people think wheat and rye and barley and all, like, that's cow food. It isn't. If you put a cow in a field and that's already gone to seed head, they'll only eat it if they absolutely, like, they're on, like, that's us eating, like, the Germans did sawdust bread in World War II.
Yep.
That's what'll get them to eat it. They want to eat grass.
Yes.
Right? They do not want to eat grain. They want to eat grass. They'll eat corn because, well, it's easier to eat than something like wheat or something like that. But they really, like, corn doesn't grow naturally. That's a made-by-hand plant, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they don't eat that. What eats a grain? Birds. Like, in nature, the only thing that actually eats grain is birds, and grain doesn't want to be eaten. Like, at least an apple wants something to eat it. A berry wants something to eat it, because then it passes through, you crap it out, and it propagates itself. But a grain, if you eat a grain, it doesn't gain any advantage. So it has chemical defenses. Like, plants use chemical defenses against us because they can't run away. Right? So all of us have different digestive, like, when I say all of us, I don't mean humans, I mean a ruminant, a human, a bird, a fish. We all have a dog. A dog has a very short digestive cycle, right? A dog can eat a rotted thing off the road and not get sick, that if you ate it, it would kill you because of that short. So we have a different digestive system. What does our digestive system say about what we should eat?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we evolved from primates that were primarily frugivore. There's no doubt about that.
Okay.
Now, many people do not realize that chimpanzees, they eat meat very regularly. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
They capture little monkeys. They capture birds. They eat lots of, insects.
Yep.
That's carnivore. All that's carnivore, whether you want to admit that or not. They do eat lots of fruit. They do eat leaves, but they will kill a young monkey in a second from another tribe or another species. They eat lots of meat. Now, gorillas don't. Gorillas eat, They're herbivores and frugivores. That's what they have to eat. Gorillas have to eat 18 hours a day, every day. Also, gorillas have to eat their own poop to get B12. That's not talked about a lot in the vegan communities, but gorillas routinely eat their own poop.
That's why chimps throw it, but gorillas don't, because they have to eat it.
So gorillas in the wild absolutely eat their own poop regularly. That's the thing that the vegans don't tell you. And so if you want to add that to your menu, I guess you can eat a vegan diet without supplementing. Now, gorillas' digestive systems are different from ours. They are what's called a hindgut fermenter. Now, ruminants are foregut fermenters, like cows, sheep, goats. They ferment in the front. That's why they chew cud. Gorillas don't do that. You ever seen a gorilla? They're pure muscle, but they also have this huge gut.
Mm-hmm.
And the rib cage flares out to accommodate that huge gut, where our rib cage is straight. So gorillas have to eat constantly, and then their bacteria in their huge cecum, their cecum is like 100 times bigger than ours. It's just a big fermenting vat, and they ferment that. That's how they are able to get all the fatty acids that they need. They cannot get it from their food. They have to get it from the bacteria in their hindgut. We do not have that capacity. If you talk to any physiologist, they'll be like, no, we do not do that. A lot of vegans try to claim we do. It's like, oh, you got to feed your gut bacteria. No, no, dude, you don't. Okay. That is, and you could just look at the prima facie evidence of the hundreds of thousands of people who have been on a carnivore diet for a year or longer. If you needed fiber to feed your gut bacteria, all those people would die. They'd be dead. They're not dead. They're actually thriving. They feel amazing. So no, that cannot be true by definition. Right? So a lot of people say, well, we don't have the teeth or the claws to be carnivores. We don't have big fangs. So therefore, well, gorillas actually do have big canine teeth. And they never eat meat, so you can't go by the teeth. That's kind of a third grade romper room answer. If anybody says we don't have large canines, therefore we're not carnivores, you can safely hit the unfollow button because they're an idiot.
Agreed.
They're an idiot if they say that. We don't have claws. The most dangerous thing that we have is our brain and our ability to communicate with each other and to plan into the future. That's what makes us the most dangerous animal on the planet, not that we have teeth or claws. That's not what makes us dangerous. They have to eat a diet of plants. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that, but they digest it in their hindgut, something we are incapable of doing. Also, their stomach pH is about 5.5 to 6.5.
Okay.
Our stomach pH is 1.5 to 2.
Now, which would burn flesh off somebody's face if you were to throw it on their face.
That's exactly right. That's why people who have bulimia, all their teeth fall out. Because that acid is not meant to be in your mouth 4 or 5 times a day. It's meant to stay in your stomach, specially designed for that. So we have that. They do not have that. And the reason we have that, and a lot of vegans will be like, well, you've got the stomach pH of a scavenger. So you should eat rotten meat. Well, that's actually part of our evolutionary process. One of the very first things that human did was we would let the lions kill whatever and eat all the meat off. We would come in when they were full and taking a nap up in the tree. We would grab what was left over. That's why we were scavengers initially. Then we learned how to break open the bones because we've got this brain. We learned how to break open the skull case. And because there's actually been anthropological research that shows that the marrow and the brains stay fresh for 3 to 5 days after a kill because they're airtight in the bone, airtight in the skull case. Now, if you find it 2 or 3 weeks later, it's going to be nasty. But if you can literally go 2 days after a kill, break open the bones, the marrow's fresh. You can eat
that. I mean, is there anything more delicious than, you know, you take some split open femur and you put it under a broiler and you broil marrow? Like, that is one of the most and people that have never tried it that make a face, like, don't do that till you try it.
Absolutely. It's amazing. Also, brain is amazing. I know it sounds gross to a lot of people. But that's why we have the stomach acid of a vulture or a buzzard, is because that's when we first stopped our old way of eating. When, for whatever reason, nobody knows, and we started to eat animals, the first thing we ate was the leftover, what the carnivores had left. We ate the brains, we ate the bone marrow. That's what we were. And so actually, lipivore is probably a better term for humans. Mm. Than carnivore. We wanted the fat. We wanted the fat in the brain, the fat in the bone marrow, and the fat on the body. And so that's where we came from. We did evolve from a common ancestor with bonobos, chips, and gorillas.
Yeah.
I don't think that's arguable. But
so we're omnivores, but we have a predisposition from hundreds of thousands of years as hunter-gatherers to live on animals. And when you were saying survival, what it made me think of is this stuff I was teasing you with this built on. The reason this exists is because and jerky and every other version of dried protein is every indigenous society. If you like, you can look in the high steppe in Mongolia today. When they kill something, they eat all the high fat first.
Yep.
And it's pure protein that gets converted into something that's more like a survival food because it'll store without refrigeration. You need salt and sun. Right. And some other ingredients if you want it to taste good, and you can make it last indefinitely.
Yep.
Or they would take the marrow and the tallow and render it and make pemmican here in North America. So you had the fat storable as well. And a little bit, they'd throw some dried berries in there to give it a little bit of sweetness.
Yep. And every indigenous culture you look at that has not been adulterated by modern society, they had a method for that. Every single one of them, without exception. And they all knew that you eat the organs, you eat the fat, those are the prize cuts.
And they go to the kids and the old people first.
Yeah. The only societies that are confused about what should we eat are societies that have some form of advertising, basically. Or they live in some kind of totalitarian regime where if you're not in the leadership, you eat the beans and rice because that's all that's given to you because they control everything.
Wasn't that a thing, too, that a lot of these dietary restrictions came from, like, royalty and pharaohs and whatever because they wanted to save the pigs and the deer and the elk for them and the red deer for themselves, and the peasants had to live on gruel?
Sure, sure, absolutely. Every culture that was a totalitarian kind of bottom-up hierarchy, that's exactly what happened. The people in charge got all the choice meat and choice cuts, and everybody else ate the beans and rice or the corn or whatever that would keep them from starving, would keep them able to show up and make bricks or whatever they were made to do.
Yeah.
They were effectively slaves, if not literally slaves. They fed them just enough to keep them from starving to death. They didn't care if they lived into old age because they had no wisdom.
They're replaceable.
They're totally irreplaceable. They're a cog in the wheel. They wanted them to work 30 years and then die.
Think about it, to this day, the royal family of England, what are their favorite three pastimes? Fishing, riding around on horses, and shooting red deer.
Yep.
Right? There's something in that royal, you know, lineage that's been handed down that shows that remnant of that, in my opinion.
Yep.
We have also, like, exported this now, right? Like, this way of eating. And I really think that really got turbocharged. I don't know if you've ever watched Food That Built America. There's some fascinating entrepreneurial stuff in there, but it's almost all garbage.
Yep.
And it all kind of went parabolic in World War II. RGIs were in the Pacific. They were in the European theater. They were in North Africa. We sent them food like Spam and shit. Like, Spam's probably the best thing that we sent over there. But we sent all our junk to, like, Coca-Cola became a global brand, really, because of World War II. And so we've exported this way of eating across the world. What have you seen the results of that being? And then the other thing I like, that when you're talking about this, but yet it is worse here, because even something as shitty as a Dorito has about 7 ingredients in the UK and about 70 in the United States. So how have you seen that play out?
Yeah, the United States definitely has the worst dietary guidelines and the worst dietary regulations of any country. And that's because we believe in a free market. We believe in capitalism. But many of us don't understand the actual definition of a free market. Leaving companies alone and letting them do their thing, that's a free market. But when this big corporation, their previous CEO is now the director of a federal government organization and they're getting little passes here and there, that's not a free market. That's actually fascism, isn't it, Jack, if I remember my definitions?
Yes.
That's what you call a collusion between big companies and big government is fascism. That's what we kind of have. We have kind of a hybrid fascist model here in the United States. And so if you look at the ingredients of ketchup in the United States versus ketchup in the UK, theirs has 3 ingredients, salt, tomatoes, water, maybe some sugar, maybe not. Ours, it's going to have 17, 18 ingredients. And that's, you would think, well, it has more ingredients, it must cost more. No, it's actually cheaper. We do everything the cheapest way we possibly can to maximize profit, which is okay unless you've got that fascist tie-in at the top, and then that just adulterates every decision. And that's the problem that I see, and that's why people need to turn away. Don't buy any food from a big corporation. Don't buy any food from a big corporation. That's an excellent principle to follow. If you're buying food from a big corporation, you're to some degree harming your health. Because
I guarantee it.
They do not care. They do not care. And they are not forced to care by our federal government. They're actually given a little leash to say, well, as long as you're not actively killing people, if you're causing cancer at the age of 50 instead of 60, that's
maybe
probably
we got to do something.
If you're causing people to develop, you know, type 2 diabetes, whereas they wouldn't, but that's not happening until they're 40 or 50, it's not a big deal. The attorneys are not going to get involved, so we don't really care about that. Whereas in other countries, they really try, at least to some extent, to keep their food supply pure, which is laudable. But we don't have that. People here in America, it's buyer beware.
Yeah.
If you're buying from a big corporation, then you're the dummy.
I really encourage, I know we got a bunch of your folks over here on Rumble because my Rumble count's way up. Usually most of my people are on YouTube. I really encourage them to check out that series. It's on History Channel, I think, Food to Build America, because one, you get a great lesson in entrepreneurship. I mean, I can't take away the fortunes that were built in this time period. But you also learn something. And it goes back before World War II, even though that's when it got mass migrated across the world. It goes back to the 1800s. These giant food companies are still around today. The people they employed to do what they did were all chemists. They were chemists. They weren't cooks.
Yep.
They figured out how to make the food. First, they made the – and to be fair, like, there was a need for it at the time. We didn't have refrigeration trucks. First thing they did was, how can I take this food and ship it from Illinois to California and not kill anybody?
Right.
But then once they got that worked out, they realized, hey, there's something here. And which stuff can I put together to hit that bliss moment where that person will crave and eat more than they otherwise would? And that's how they've built this diet of people that are the most metabolically unhealthy, I believe, that humans have ever been. I don't think we'd be here if we were this metabolically unhealthy 1,000 years ago. We wouldn't have made it.
Totally agree. And it really did. Everything shifted around World War II and right after. We shifted from a necessity model for everything. So used to, before World War II, you would buy one or two pairs of shoes a year. Literally, that's it. If somebody tried to sell you a third pair, you'd be like, what are you, a moron? I've got a perfectly good pair of shoes. I don't need a pair of shoes that's a different color. I don't care. So after World War II, coming into the, and then into the 50s and 60s, all of a sudden this consumption model took over America because we had all this excess stuff that we needed to sell. So now you need a pair of shoes in every color. You need a pair of pants in every color. You need a new washing machine every 3 or 4 years because, oh, it's got this new dial on it or whatever. That same kind of philosophy bled into the food. Oh, it needs to be the best tasting food you ever had in your life. And so food scientists and chemists did come up with this thing they call the bliss point, which is the perfect ratio of salt, sugar, and fat. Typically fat from vegetable oils because it's much cheaper than fat from animals and it's much more shelf stable. And so that's why the potato chip companies can brag that you can't eat just one because they literally have scientifically hit the point where the average person cannot just eat one, just one potato chip. It's almost biologically impossible. You're going to eat the whole bag.
Yeah. Where has this put us? Like, how would you rate the health of Americans on average, and specifically take out us, people that have discovered this way of eating, and take out the people that are 400 pounds? Like, the average person walking down the street, you go, hey, you could lose a little bit of weight, but yeah, all right. Like, what state of health is the average American really in?
So about 90% of American adults have at least one marker of metabolic syndrome. Only 10 to 12% of adults in the United States would be considered metabolically healthy if you check their blood pressure, check their waistline, check some blood work. Only about 1 out of 10 is actually metabolically healthy. Now, are they following some kind of a diet? Probably. But the average person that's just eating whatever, they go out to eat, they buy stuff from the supermarket in the middle of the store, packaged stuff, they buy the big 5-pound bag of generic, you know, Lucky Charms because it's cheaper, they buy plant milks because they heard that's healthy. 100% of those people are metabolically unwell. They're inflamed. You see the rates of obesity in children skyrocketing. You see, if you go back in time just 100 years and you took 100 2-year-old children, nobody would be obese. There would be no child with obesity, no child with type 2 diabetes, no child with fatty liver. Now you take 100 random kids who are 2, 3, 4, 5 years of age, there's a significant percentage who have pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes, a significant percent who are overweight or obese. When you're making the children metabolically sick, you're doing a lot of stuff real damn wrong, not just a little wrong, but way wrong, because it's really hard to make a child obese or have metabolic syndrome or have fatty liver or have neuropathy before their 12th birthday. You got to really be effing it up bad for that to be happening. And that's currently what's happening in the United States.
I mean, we're only a few years apart on age. You are older, I'll just point that out. Yeah. But we grew up in the 70s and 80s.
Yep.
I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, we ate everything.
Yes.
You could go down to the penny candy store with a buck.
Yep.
And you could eat more sugar. Like, even though you were like parents limited us on sugar, but you get away with a dollar. You could go in there and get 100 fish or gummy bears or whatever for a buck. And nobody I went to school with, save one, I can remember the fat kid in high school. His name was Jason, right? Yep. One fat kid. And this dude would eat like six hot dogs on one bun, right? Like, so like that's an outlier. None of us were fat. Even eating food that you and I would say don't eat today. Because we were kids and our metabolism was up here.
That's right.
And now we got the skinny kid in high school.
Yep. And
I mean,
most people who grew up in the 70s, they had, if you ask them, how many fat kids in your class, they'd be like, well, one. I remember him. He was my buddy. I remember his name. I'm not going to say it. But he literally, out of 120 kids in Hornwall Elementary School, there was one fat kid. And you had one fat kid in your class, and most people who grew up in the 60s are like either had none or they had one. In the 70s, there was one, maybe two, but usually one. And then when you start growing up in the 80s, you're like, oh, we had a few fat kids. And it's like each decade, there's more and more fat kids. Well, what changed?
Yeah.
Well, when me and Jack went home to eat, you were eating real whole food.
Correct.
That's what you got for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then you got sent outside to play in the sun the rest of the day, and you got a spanking if you came in unless you were sick or had to poop. That's the only time you could come in the house.
Or man, we weren't allowed. Like, I just saw a thing on TikTok where this chick was answering this guy, and he goes, you Gen X guys, like, was the sink not an option? And she's like, should I tell them? We weren't allowed in the house, especially in the summer.
Right.
Right? Get out. Go do something, or I'll give you work to do.
Yep. And so Granny Berry, I could come in to poop, or I could come in if I was sick or if I had broke a bone. But otherwise, no, you're playing until, because you're not going to get my house dirty. It's not going to happen.
When the street light comes on, you better be home or made a phone call. Otherwise, get out of here.
Exactly. Exactly right. And people don't, there's generations who are like, that can't be right. Yes.
Yes.
That was how you showed love in the 70s.
And like my uncle used to take me Sunday after church to the gun club, and it was a gun club's a bar with a bunch of guys that own guns talking about guns and hunting.
Yeah,
and they'd take me in the bar and they'd sit me up on a table. I'm talking about 8, 9 years old, and I would get a soda with a regional thing called the Green Spot. It was kind of like a Mountain Dew or a Sprite, and it was in like a 7-ounce returnable bottle.
Yep.
And I got one of those a week.
Yep.
One of those a week. I didn't get a big gulp or any of that crap. I mean, like. That was normal for us. And I didn't, I don't know about you, I didn't ever feel like I was missing out.
Yeah.
And now I will say, like, my grandparents are Ukrainians, right? So, like, there's a lot of starches in that, potatoes, pierogi, stuff like that. We ate that shit, too.
Yep.
And even, like, the older people in the family, they look more like what you're talking about with the Asian, the little pooch belly, but nobody was obese at all, even eating, you know, I don't know how many carbs are in a pierogi, but I know there's a bunch of them in 10. Right? And I mean, we used to just tear that stuff up. But for some reason, nobody really, and I think it's because we didn't live on it. It was like there was a variance to that diet, too.
Exactly. And I guarantee you, if we went back in time with carb manager or chronometer, one of these macro counters, and we figured up your diet when you were 10 years old over the course of a month, it would be a lower carb diet.
I bet it would.
More carb. Even though you did sneak off and eat that candy, you had a pierogi, you had dessert, but it still was not much over 100 total grams of carbs a day. I guarantee you that's the case for all kids, because back then parents cooked, and you could have an occasional treat, but you were not going to McDonald's for three meals a day where there's the Sunday, might as well get it. That didn't happen back then. You got a little bit of dessert, but you had to eat your meat or you weren't getting dessert.
Yeah, I don't know about you. I never really wanted to eat the potatoes or whatever. I told my grandma, I figured it out, that the meat was more expensive. So you feeding me potatoes, so I'll eat less of the meat.
Right? Absolutely.
You know, like it's a little kid that doesn't want to eat the meat because they're not really, because we start them on garbage, basically. I know you start your kid on like beef ribs.
That's right.
But like you hit this point around 6 or 7 or 8, like you're like, well, how come Grandpa got more steak than me? How come Grandpa's steak's rare and my shit's well done because I got a piece of Mom's? Like, I want that red stuff. Like, yep. That was me as a kid, and that was most of my friends. And we lived on deer. We went fishing. We lived on fish. I ate probably more squirrels between the time I was 6 and 12 than I ate donuts.
Yeah, I love, right? Love squirrel, man. Love squirrel hunting. But, and so I think a big part of the problem is we're starting kids super early on junk.
Cheerios.
Yeah, and so the average parent's like, I would never give my kid junk. And then I dig into their diaper bag, and I'm like, this is junk, this is junk, this is junk. And they're like, no, this is made by Gerber. It says contains blah. I'm like, this is literal junk. This is ground up grains, vegetable seed oil, and either added sugar or natural sugar, which is sugar. Literally, you're feeding your kid ding dongs and Doritos, but it's got that little smiley Gerber baby on it. So it says approved by a pediatrician who's bought off. You're feeding your children junk. Fruit juice is worse for your children than just giving them Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Parents are like, what did you fall and hit your head? What are you talking about? Yeah. Grape juice, apple juice, orange juice has more fructose than the high fructose corn syrup in Coca-Cola or Pepsi.
Yes.
You're feeding your kids a junk food diet, and you're wondering why we've got all these epidemics of childhood diabetes and obesity.
Yeah, that mother that gives that kid a baby bottle full of apple juice, I'm not going to say none of them. Most of them would never fill that bottle up with Coke or Pepsi.
True.
But there's more sugar in the freaking apple juice than there is in the Coke or the Pepsi. Yeah. You know, like, honestly, I remember things like you get kids to drink water and shit, mom would throw, like, an ounce of apple juice into like a 12-ounce glass of water.
Yep.
Because they even knew then that this is just sugar. I mean, it's pure sugar. Juicing, like all this cancer shit that people talk about with juicing, I'm like, you just want to feed the tumor?
Exactly.
Right? That's what you're doing. Sugar is tumor fuel. Yep. So you take a carrot, which isn't great, but it ain't that bad, and then you juice it and throw away all the bulk and take – it's pure sugar.
Yep.
And people look at you sideways when you tell them it's pure sugar. Honey, I know you and I have had many arguments with people about honey, right? But it's honey, so it's sugar. I'm not going to say it's ounce for ounce sugar because there's some other things in it, but the part that's sugar is ounce for ounce the same as table sugar.
Absolutely. It's actually worse. It's higher in fructose. It's just like high fructose corn syrup. If you take the water out of honey, it's super high fructose corn syrup. You cannot.
I've been told, shut up. You're not a doctor. You're not a scientist yet. You don't know anything. You happen to be a doctor. And I get a lot of shit when I say this. Fructose in your liver acts almost one small process different, almost exactly like ethyl alcohol.
Yep.
And it puts a load on your liver that's equivalent to ethyl alcohol, but we don't feed ethyl alcohol to babies, but we fructose to babies.
Yep. Because it's natural.
Yeah, it's natural.
Because we've forgotten what is actually natural, what's actually proper, because you have to go way back in time to get that. So there are many cultures who are literally claiming a slave diet as their heritage.
Is their heritage. We were all slaves at one time.
But what they mean by heritage is what did mom and grandma eat? That's what they think that's their heritage.
I see.
No. The reason you're eating that is because your parents and grandparents were so damn poor, they had to cut the meat with beans and rice, or otherwise there would be no food. When we go to San Antonio and visit with Nisha's Puerto Rican family, that's their heritage. And they'll argue with me. I'm like, no, if you go back enough generations, that's 100% not your heritage.
Yeah.
You guys came through the eye of a needle where you were so poor that you almost starved to death. You learned to eat rice and beans, and now you think that's your heritage, but it's really not.
Yeah, my childhood was split between Jacksonville, Florida, and central Pennsylvania. And down in Florida, the friends that I had that were really poor, like we didn't have a lot, but they were really poor, they must ate 4 or 5 nights a week, either shrimp and grits or fish and grits. And it was light on the fish and heavy on the grits. And it was because back then you could buy like a 25-pound box of grits for like $3.
Yep.
Right? So it wasn't that we're eating this because we're, you know, North Florida crackers or whatever, and we like grits. It was, I was a Catholic family, so like these friends of mine, they had like 4 kids.
Yeah.
Like, I got to feed 4 kids and mom doesn't work, and I can buy enough grits to feed them for a month for $5. Yep. That's why they ate it. Absolutely. But at least they put butter in it instead of margarine. I will give them that.
Well, that's because they couldn't afford the margarine, probably. It used to cost more than butter.
It did used to cost more than butter.
Yeah, yeah. And so, but many people, they consider that their heritage, their culture. And it's like, I'm trying to take that. I'm like, no, what I want you to do is eat the diet of your original ancestors, not the last two generations, because the last two generations came through the Great Depression and they almost starved to death. So they learned how to enjoy grits. But I promise you, if you go back enough generations, they were not eating grits and they would laugh at you for eating grits.
No, grits taste like ass unless you load them up with butter and cheese. And then they taste pretty good, but let's be honest, you're eating butter and cheese and probably bacon grease.
Absolutely.
If somebody does it right.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, it looks like farina for babies or something. It's
exactly
like,
that.
If you want to know what shitty grits actually taste like, go to, what is that, like Cracker Barrel. Eat the shit they give you, and that's what grits actually taste like. And no damn person would really want to eat that, in my opinion. I mean, it's not food. Now, what I've seen, and I you clued me into this. I knew type 2 diabetes was bad. But you made a statement on this show probably 6 years ago that there were more dialysis clinics than Subway restaurants now. And I'm like, well, I think it's a little over the top. And then I paid attention the next time I drove to Fort Worth from my house, which is about a 20-minute drive, and I saw 3 dialysis clinics on one road on a 15, 20-minute drive.
Yep.
And I started looking at that, and I found a company called DaVita, mutual hated friend of ours, I guess you'd say, or enemy, frenemy. And they own 6,600. These are like the small remote dialysis clinics, not going to the hospital, across the country.
Yep.
They make money on one thing, dialysis. That's the only thing they make money on. But they've partnered with your other friends over at the American Diabetes Association to start putting out recipes for diabetics.
Yep. The leading cause of kidney failure is diabetes.
And I just wanted you to comment on this. I'll put this up on the screen. This is the food that they are. I'm not making this shit up for those watching the video. Like some of y'all getting the audio. For those getting the audio only, we're looking at cranberry oatmeal cookies and popcorn and a turkey burger with a bun that's 5 times larger than the burger. And that's just a sampling of what these two organizations have come together to recommend people who already have freaking diabetes eat.
Yes.
How does this make any sense?
Well, it only makes sense one way. Yeah, I guess you could say, well, a person with diabetes deserves the right to eat cranberry cookies too. I guess you could look at it like that, like a 3-year-old. But what I look at is what foods make diabetes progress faster? What foods, if a diabetic eats them, will make their kidneys fail faster? It's actually the foods in the picture. That's the foods that will make your kidneys fail even faster. Now, is that the plan of DaVita, is to have more people with kidney failure so that they can die?
But it feels that way.
It feels that way. Now, I'm not conspiratorial. I'm like Jack. I try to just look for the common sense of this. And often the actual answer is just stupidity, ignorance, and laziness explains a lot of things. It doesn't have to be a conspiracy. But when you've got the American Diabetes Association recommending high sugar foods, high carb recipes, and then all of a sudden DaVita, who own their only source of product, profit, is dialyzing people with kidney failure. And now they're coming up and they're partnering to make these high carb recipes. I mean, I can't really fault the conspiratorially minded people from going, wait a minute, that smells fishy to me. It kind of smells fishy to me too. It smells so fishy, in fact, that I started reaching out to the American Diabetes Association saying, hey, you guys only got 25,000 followers on your YouTube channel. I got 3.1 million. Why don't you have your doctor come on my channel and we can talk about a proper diet for people with diabetes? And I figured they'd immediately take me up on that.
Wait a minute. Let me do Johnny Carson, 1980s. I know you were a kid watching that with your grandpa, too. They said no.
No, they didn't even say no.
They said nothing.
They said nothing. I got no reply. I would tweet to them. I would retweet them. I would quote tweet them. It's like, hey, come on my channel. I got 3 million people that are waiting to hear what you've got to say. No reply whatsoever. I have a friend who's a professor at Harvard, who's an endocrinologist. He's actually went to school with Dr. Gathay. the chief medical officer of the ADA. He's like, oh, I bet he's not seeing that. I'll reach out to Bob. So he emails him and CCs me on the email. These guys went to school together. Bob didn't answer him. So at some point I said, you know, I think they're not interesting in having a conversation. Also, if you go to the ADA's YouTube channel, if you watch one of their videos and you want to ask a question, you can't. They've got comments turned off. You're like, wait, what? Now, Jack's going to go check that right now because he's like me. He's like from Missouri.
I've seen him do it. I've seen him do it. Like, they don't always do it, but a lot of times they'll put some shit out.
All you guys go to the ADA and try to leave a comment on one of their videos. You can't. They got the comments turned off. You can't ask a question. So at some point, I reached out to some other low-carb, keto, carnivore-friendly doctors, and I said, you know what we need to do? And I Googled formation of the ADA. The way they were founded is six doctors got together back in the 30s, 41, somewhere in there. And they said, you know, there should be an association of doctors who take care of people with diabetes. Okay. And they're like, that's a good idea. Let's form that. Boom, ADA. Okay. Now, back then, they gave pretty decent advice. But now, it's been completely co-opted by Big Food and Big Pharma, who gives them, they write them a check for $1 million every year, multiple big corporations. And so if the ADA did come on my channel and let me ask them questions and have a conversation with me, they'd probably lose $2 or $3 million in donations.
Mm.
Right? They don't want to have that conversation because their budget's $100 million a year. They gotta have those donations from Eli Lilly and from Novartis and from Kellogg's and Kraft and Mondelez and General Mills. They gotta have those to keep, or they'll have to lay people off. So me and a few low carb doctors got together and we said, fine, we'll form a diabetes association, a society. And so we did that. And we, in our articles of incorporation, it's in the articles. We will never take a penny from Big Food or Big Pharma right off the bat. Don't send us a check because we know there's going to be strings attached or worse, chains. We'll never take your money. And we're going to actually give people with diabetes good nutrition advice. Good recipes that will actually lower your A1C, that will actually lower your blood sugar, that will actually keep you out of the dialysis clinic. So obviously we're never going to get a check from DaVita or the other one, right? Because they don't want to waste their money on us because we're going to be taking money out of their mouth. We're going to keep people out of the dialysis clinic. We're going to keep people from having to have a leg amputated. We're going to keep people from going blind because of diabetes.
But artificial intelligence already knows about it. I just went and Brave Search runs like an AI on the back end of their search when you do certain queries, and you're already here. The American Diabetes Society is a new nonprofit organization founded by Dr. Ken Berry, a family physician. So you've already achieved AI fame with this.
I did not know that.
I didn't know until now either. I was just looking for your GoFundMe, and boom, there it is.
So this is going to be a nonprofit, donations only. Never will we take a penny from Big Food or Big Pharma. We're going to take money from people who hopefully I've helped reverse their type 2 diabetes, or we've helped improve their health in some way. We'll take money from that kind of people, from a company that makes real food. And so just in a few weeks, we've raised $103,000 on a GoFundMe. And you know, Jack, a lot of people hate GoFundMe because of some previous actions of theirs. Mm-hmm. We still raised $103,000. Now, the nonprofit will soon be up and running. We'll soon have a website, and we'll soon have a way to donate that's not GoFundMe. So if somebody wants to write a big check, they can get a receipt and turn that in with their taxes. We're going to be putting out guidelines, press releases, recipes, treatment guideline protocols for doctors and dietitians, so that they can actually help people with type 2 diabetes reverse their type 2 diabetes and no longer have it. The American Diabetes Association says partners for life, and they mean it, because if you eat the recipes on your website, you will have diabetes forever.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you will. You will be a partner for life. I don't want
you to be a partner for life. I'll take it beyond that, Ken. I think if you eat their recipes, what will happen is you'll actually end up eating more carbohydrates than you would have otherwise. Yep. Not just from their recipes, because so if you have somebody who's been through a 12-step alcoholic process, right, and they've come off alcohol and they haven't had a drink in 90 days, the last place that person needs to be is in a bar and have just one highball. They'll train wreck themselves, right, when they come back onto it because, oh, that's what it feels like. And this biochemical response we get when we put fat and sugar together is real. And my view is that goes back to anthropology.
Yep.
You don't find that in nature very often. It's incredibly rare that the fig trees and the salmon are available at the same time.
That's
since
right.
They don't exist in the same latitude, right?
Right.
They don't exist there. There's very rare times where there's lots of protein and fat and lots of sugar, and it usually coincides with very early spring when you're coming out of like the human version of hibernation, or right at the end of summer when you're about to go through a very long fasting period.
When you need to put on 5 or 10 pounds of fat.
So I think that we're literally wired that if you can get berries and squirrel fat at the same time to just eat our asses off. So when you give somebody a cranberry cookie as a dessert after dinner, and they even, because you know what's going to happen, they're going to make the cranberry cookie, say it's from ADA, and they're going to shove 50 of them in their mouth. Right? Even if they eat one or two like they're supposed to, what happens 30 minutes later to that person sitting there watching TV? What happens? Say it.
Now they're craving sugar. They're going to go search the pantry and they're going to find some more sugar. You just knocked them off the wagon with your American Diabetes Association recipe.
Yep.
Now, is that the intention or are they somehow well-meaning but ill-informed? I don't know. They're the freaking American Diabetes Association. You would think they've had this figured out by now. Many people will say, yeah, they do have it figured out. They want a partner for life. They want you to have diabetes for life, so you'll buy all the food from their sponsors and all the drugs from their sponsors, and then their other sponsor, DaVita, will dialyze them once the diabetes has killed their kidneys. I don't know what the truth is, and I don't really care. What I want to do is help as many people with type 2 diabetes reverse their type 2 diabetes as possible. That's what the American Diabetes Society is for. So if any of your folks have got an extra 5, 10, 20 bucks you want to donate, we'd love to take it and use it to reverse type 2 diabetes in millions and millions of people. That's our mission. That's our goal. We will never be bought out. We will never be sold. We will never, ever partner with a big food or a big pharma or big dialysis. We will never do that. That will not happen.
Well, and I'm going to make sure that this link, because this is really long, is in the audio version of this podcast once this live stream's over. About 30 minutes after this ends, there's a link in the video notes. You guys on Rumble over there, you guys too, if you click that link, all of Ken's resources will be in the audio version, in the notes that go with it. And yeah, get on over and throw some money at this, because God knows the amount of money being thrown at everything else is ridiculous.
Yep.
And I'm like Ken, I don't want to believe that these people are intentionally killing people. But I also know that whether it's intentional or not, they're killing people. And if it's ignorance, it's the most willful ignorance I've ever seen in my life. It's more willful ignorance than the press and politics. It's beyond comprehension that doctors and people who run a company that's sophisticated enough to develop dialysis equipment and manage dialysis equipment don't know what they're doing. And then I would ask you again, I hate saying it this way, but what other motivation would there be for a for-profit corporation that only makes money doing dialysis than to make more patients? That sounds horrible, doesn't it? But
yeah, I mean, it's kind of what's the other alternative explanation? I don't know. Now I got to run to another thing, Jack. I always love chatting with you and hanging out with your peeps. I really appreciate the invite. Thanks to anybody who's able to donate 5, 10, 20, whatever you can afford. That's fine, because we're going to turn that money into type 2 diabetes reversals times 1,000. That's what we're going to do. We're going to put some of these big food and big pharma companies out of business, because they don't deserve to be in business, because they're slowly killing people. And I'm sick and tired of it.
Can you, before you go, close with this comment on this? I get that we're stuck with the term diabetes.
Yep.
But I do not even believe it is the right word to describe what we call type 2 diabetes. I get a lot of shit when I say that. Can you explain that, and I'll let you go, and I'll handle wrap up.
Yeah, I think that probably the ADS, when we've met with our board of directors, we're probably going to rename it something like carbohydrate overdose syndrome or carbohydrate toxicity syndrome. because people are just eating too many carbohydrates. And when they stop that, the diabetes goes away. It's almost like it's an exposure or a poisoning versus a medical condition that's idiopathic and we don't know what causes it.
Yeah.
Type one's completely different, but type 2 diabetes is just carbohydrate overdose syndrome. That's all it is.
And I think it can get bad enough that it becomes irreversible because you do so much damage. It's like a de facto type 1. But I would say the vast majority of people with type 2 diabetes can be completely reversed. And I find it fucking criminal that is not the goal of the average doctor. Doctors talk about this shit like a disease that you got, like you caught. Like you caught the flu or something.
You inherited.
If you're stuck with it, I'm sorry it happens. As though it's the same as type 1 diabetes, it's not.
Not at all. And that's part of our mission at the ADS is to educate doctors, dietitians, people on the street. That's not what type 2 is. Type 2 is just too many carbohydrates. Cut the carbs. Type 2 diabetes goes away. Jack, thank you so much.
Thanks,
for having
Ken.
Me, brother. It's always a pleasure.
All right. Take care, bro.
See you next time.
All right, guys. I'm going to handle the Q&A portion as best I can without Ken here. There's not a ton, so I'll do what I can with it. But Rodney says, what country has the best eating habits? I don't know what Ken would say about that. I would say none of them. Really, like, when you get into, like, the nation state level of things, it would be more like regions within states. So if you were to get out into the countryside of Russia, not Moscow, not St. Petersburg, you'd find people living very different lives. Or Slovenia, places like that. If you look at what these people eat, they eat an awful lot of fresh fish that's caught from their local waters. They do use a lot of potato and things like that, but it looks a lot more like what you'd be accustomed to from the 70s, 80s United States than what you'd be accustomed to today. And so I think it's more like the remaining indigenous populations and including indigenous populations that we don't recognize that way because they're not running around in tattoos and a loincloth. But if you look at like rural Russia and the way people live in rural Russia, they're wearing clothing that looks like ours, but they're really indigenous population. And I think that's where you'll find the best dietary habits that are not intentional. They're just, that's the way it's always been. And they're still going. Larry, who threw me a $20 super chat, thank you for that. Insulin defiant. I'm trying to make this a thing. Type 2 diabetic here. I've got it licked now by diet and exercise, but if I stop exercising and eat lazy, I'll be around 300 again within a week. And yeah, you will. And that's kind of where I had Ken right before we left talk about is that it really isn't diabetes. It's recreating the same scenario as diabetes. But it's not diabetes is your pancreas doesn't make insulin, and without insulin injections, you will die. And it's genetic. It's wired into our code. And people that had that type of diabetes not so long ago would end up, once they had onset, dying. And there's just like the only way we can help that person is to give them insulin. A type 2 diabetic in general is making more insulin than a non-diabetic, but they have insulin resistance, or as Larry is saying here, insulin defiance. And so it takes more insulin to get the same net effect. And so the solution then becomes tell this person to eat oatmeal, which is terrible, and give them supplemental insulin. So now we're adding to the already overproduction of insulin. And all of these problems are hormonal, and one of the ways you can understand that is if I took two kids about 8 years old in decent health, and a boy and a girl, but I like the girl has short hair or something, so you can't tell who's who by a dress outline, just a body silhouette. So you got dark imagery of the silhouette against like a blank screen, and you looked at that, and I said, who's the girl and who's the boy? You might as well flip a coin. You got a 50-50 shot of picking which one of those two is the boy or the girl. Yeah? Okay. Flash forward about 16. Both of them still healthy, so we don't have, obesity going on or anything. And I do the same experiment. You're like, that's the girl, that's the boy. Well, why? because the hips are curvy, there's, you know, breasts involved, the male has more of a broad shoulder, broad chest, etc. Woman's got a little bit more fat on her hips and thighs. I'm talking healthy here. What told that girl's body to put a little bit more fat on the hips, to take some fat tissue and develop the breasts? Did an alien come down from outer space and beam it in? Did she take some sort of supplement that made that happen? Or did the hormones in her body, since she is a female, the estrogen and other things say, this is how they develop the human body for a female, and the male with testosterone built more muscle, et cetera, without working out or anything. What did that? The endocrine system, right? The hormones. And so when we eat food that disrupts our hormones, all of a sudden you got moobs rolling around, right? You got dudes with butts that look like a woman with a Brazilian butt lift. It's all hormonal. And the hormones are being driven out of whack by the diet. And I'm with Ken with what he kind of alluded to. I might eat this way. You don't have to. But if you don't bring it in check, and I like that number, like at least start going under 100 carbohydrates. Because if you don't do that, you're not going to know if this works for you. And you might find you need to come down from there. I can honestly eat about 10 carbohydrates a meal with no ill effects on a 2-MAD, a 2-meal-a-day diet. Like, I can't do that if I eat 3 meals a day. And so I generally am a 2-meal-a-day. I do intermittent fasting just by proxy. I'm usually in about a 4 to 6 hour window of eating, and that works for me. You may not need to do anything like that, but definitely cut back. Now, someone asked me about Chris Palmer's story, and I bet you Ken had an answer for that. That was their question that came over here from Rumble. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that study. If whoever asked that on Rumble is still there, if you want to explain, like, if you get in one or two sentences to explain the gist of that, I can comment on it. Otherwise, I have to skip out on it because I don't talk about things I don't know. Question from Dark Horse. Is sugar more addictive than Coke? And I think he means cocaine. Yes and no. This is my opinion. I can't prove this. I think sugar to itself isn't necessarily more addictive. Sugar combined with fat, and it doesn't matter if it's a healthy fat or an unhealthy fat, I believe that triggers a reaction in humans that is definitely more addictive than cocaine and probably just about any other drug out there. And I do believe it is because we are hardwired. And I mentioned that when Ken and I were talking. When that overlap occurs in nature, it is exceedingly rare. I mean, go try to find it. Go take a walk in the wilderness, right? You know, like if you wanted to ask me, like, Jack, where would be the easiest place in the United States, lower 48, to survive in the woods or on the beach or whatever without a lot of equipment? Like, you don't, like, if you're on the Florida coast, give me some fishing gear and I'll eat. But I don't have all that. I just got to make do with what I have. The Pacific coast, specifically the North Pacific coast, or the swamps of the Southeast. Both of those, I'll never be hungry. But you know what I won't find? A large amount of sugar and protein and fat all in one place. You want to eat well on the West Coast? All you got to do is take a walk at low tide. And you will find the thing that, when I did the anthropological research, the dominant thing that human settlement had in common for food, if we take it across the world, not just in this one little area, but across the world, say aggregate average, shellfish. Which makes perfect sense. It's high fat, it's high cholesterol, it's high protein, it's almost no carbohydrates. Some shellfish have, like, you know, a little bit of carbohydrate, but not much. It doesn't run away, and it's easy to get. Go into the swamps of Florida. Turn a log over. There's some critter under there you can club and eat. Yeah, I used to joke, you drop me off in a swamp, pick me up in 60 days, I'll gain weight. Truth is, I really won't, but I damn well won't be hungry. But where are you going to find a lot of sugar and a lot of fat in nature at the same time over a long duration, especially over a year? And the answer is you're not. You're not. So I think that that's where that trigger comes. And maybe addiction is not the right word, some sort of biological imperative. because our genetics do not know that we have Piggly Wiggly and Albertsons and Kroger to go to 24/7, 365. Our genetics are still based on 10,000 years ago and back. We are not different beings than the man that was walking this planet, you know, 12,000 years ago. Genetically, we are the same. We have the same brains. We have the same ability to work things out. Our technology is more advanced, but that's a function of time, not intelligence. If you go back and do research on the way human settlements were a couple thousand years ago, the technology we had is for the time is impressive as shit. We still can't make concrete as good as the Romans made. Think about that. So we are the same people, same person. Dark Horse says, can you change your cravings to healthy ones? I believe so, because, you know, this stuff here, this dry sausage is one of the most craveable things I've ever eaten. I'm not saying that because they're a sponsor. If you said to me, Jack, if you're a little bit hungry, you can have anything you want. Wave your hand, it'll show up in front of you. It's going to be something like a biltong or a ribeye. And that's what I crave above all things now. It's basically meat and salt with lots of fat in it. And so I think what happens is when you build your diet on something and you're not afraid to let yourself get hungry. And this is one of the real problems in America today. We won't let ourselves be hungry. Well, I'm hungry. I got to eat. That's not how we evolved. You know, you weren't walking around 10,000 years ago and be like, I'm going to stop at 7-Eleven and get a Big Gulp and a Corny Dog. That's not how that worked. Right, you had to do without. And if you allow yourself to actually really be hungry, not craving something because it's been 3 hours since you ate, like your stomach's empty and your body has used the food you ate the last time you ate and you're now drawing from your fat reserves and you're hungry, man, a lot of things that you didn't think you wanted to eat, they start tasting pretty good. I remember as a little kid, now this is not keto carnivore at all, but I remember one time we went camping. I was probably 7, 8 years old. And we made some just plain old Campbell's pork and beans with some hot dogs in a pan over a campfire. And I remember telling my dad, those were the best beans. And I didn't really like beans. I'm like, they were the best beans I ever ate in my life. He said, well, that's because you went 14 hours without any food. So I think we can definitely develop healthy cravings if we'll, you know, one, eat the healthy food. To find the healthy food that we're most predisposed to like and give ourselves variety. People tell me, well, keto's boring. Carnivore's boring. No, you're a boring cook. I post pictures. Like you guys that are still hanging out over here on Rumble that are out of Ken's crew, go to my site, thesurvivalpodcast.com. Follow me on social. I post pictures of what I cook all the time. And sometimes it's leftover stuff. And people are like, you're cooking like a restaurant chef. Well, no one stops you from doing that. No one stops you from doing that. If you start looking, back years ago, I used to sell computer hardware. And we had this modular switch, meaning that you could throw 6 RJ45s and 2 fiber connections. And you had all these different modules you could stick in it. But it was really one case and about 12 different modules. And one day somebody in our marketing department got a hair up their ass and said, well, how many... And there was different power options too, like there was DC power, AC power, neg 48 volt, which is telcos use, and there was some different power options as well in there. And they came up with it was something like 38,000 different ways you could configure this one thing with these modules and power options. But we have a lot more options as people that are carnivorous or ketovore. Especially if you go into the ketovore space where you can have some peppers, or you can have, like I said, I use cilantro a lot. I use greens a lot, things like that. If you open that up and then you think about the different ways you can season things using herbs and stuff like that, you could go 10 years and never eat the exact same thing 2 days in a row. Question, assuming good numbers, is a bit of fat like lineman power lifter okay? I don't know what that is. Missile launch. If you want to tell me what that is real quick, because I'm really not sure what you're asking me there. Is that a product that is designed to like boost your fat intake? If you're going to do that, MCTs, medium chain triglycerides, that is generally made from coconut fat is probably the best option in that world. I don't think you need it. I don't think you need it. I will say something on behalf of using MCTs. When you look at the effect of MCT, which I know is a plant-based fat, but it's not a seed oil, right? It's more accurately a nut oil, I guess. The other thing I'm big on, if you're going to use a fat that comes from a plant, you should be able to basically squeeze or extract the fat and do nothing to it, which you can do with coconut oil. If you want to make sure you never eat canola oil again, just go look at how they make it. Once you see how they make it, you can't possibly want to eat it. But the MCTs, it's almost a net negative because it ramps up your, and this has been studied and figured out, it ramps your metabolism up to where if you consume about 150 calories of MCT, you're gonna actually burn about 130 more. So it's a net of only like 20 additional calories. But I haven't used it since I was in my heavy weight loss stage, and I don't think that it was necessary or is necessary, but I don't have a problem with it. So I don't mean I don't know if you're asking about something like that. I don't see Missile Launch clarifying that, even though I think he's still here. So if you want to clarify that, I'll do what I can. Plus One says, what did you use as motivation when you fell off the wagon hard from your diet, down from 270 to 215 since December because of y'all? You know, I'll tell you, if you go back on my YouTube channel, you can find a series called Jack's Low Carb Journey when I lost the weight. And there's a point, and I don't remember if it was 25 or 35 pounds that I was down at that point. And I brought a weight into this, sitting right here in this chair. And I was trying to motivate people. And I said, and this is what I've lost. And it had been like 40 days, and I dropped that weight. I don't have to go look at that because I remember it. And I remember the sound, thud of that weight dropping. I had people email me who were doing it with me, and they said, I went and, you know, got the same amount of weight and did what you did. I have several grown-ass men tell me they cried when they realized what they had done for themselves in such a short period of time. To me, whenever I think, oh, well, I can eat this or I can eat that, and honest to God, you know, Thanksgiving, I'm going to eat a little bit of stuffing and potatoes because it's Thanksgiving. Like, I'm talking about, like, not sticking to it. I just think about that moment. And I think about that human being that I was before I did this for myself. Or I just go look at a picture of myself from 7 years ago, and my face is like this. I don't need any further motivation than that. I will never become that man ever again. I will never become that person ever again because unbecoming that man was too hard. It was too hard that I'm in my 50s now. It's too hard to do again at 60. If you're 60, I want you to do it. Don't get me wrong. But since I already did it, I already went through it. I already let myself get up over 300 freaking pounds. Right? I say I lost 70. That's when I started tracking it. That's when I started tracking it, and I was 280. I was over 300. I never weighed myself when I was that heavy. I couldn't face it. That should be enough motivation for anybody, is understanding. And I would tell you, as you lose weight, yeah, you lose 20 pounds, pick up a 20-pound dumbbell and drop it somewhere it won't break anything. And when you let go of it, let go of that piece of you that you killed because it needed to die. I don't know how to motivate you any more than that. Missile Launch says, big dudes like linemen or powerlifters are pudgy at minimum. Okay. So he's saying these guys that are out there lifting as much weight as they can and they have some fat. He's not about eating fat. He's talking about having some fat on you. There is no doubt the guys that can lift the most weight are carrying some fat. I don't think it's probably the best thing long term. But I think the muscle that those guys have sort of offsets that. When I started doing this, I was obese based on government guidelines for my height and weight and measurements. I'm considered fit for 40, and I'm 52. And I would rather be that than be able to lift more weight because I'm carrying fat on my body. I'll tell you that. And I do have some fat. I think a healthy human being has some fat on their body, but it should not be obvious fat. I don't think you I also don't think you need to be the dude that has that rock hard, you know, 6-pack, 8-pack abs. If you want to be that, you want to do the work for it, or you're naturally predisposed for it, that's fine. But I don't think you need to be that either. And I think that, you know, when you get into stuff like that, like if you're going to be competitive in athletics, then you tool yourself to that. So that's my best on that. Anyway, that's all I got for you guys today. I do want to real quick remind you guys how you can help support this show and the work that I do. I have a section of my website that if you type TSPAZ, TSPAZ.com into, you get redirected down to that section. It's where I've reviewed all the products that I've reviewed over the years, either from Vivor or from Amazon. And they're honest reviews. They're products I own, I've used, I've tried out, and I would spend my money on it again, or I wouldn't recommend it. Today's time of the day, I've got Vivor back around again today because they've got these raised garden beds back in check. Like I said, I don't eat 100% meat. I do eat some vegetables. I do grow a garden. And building garden beds is a pain in the ass, and it's gotten really expensive with the price of lumber. These are made of galvanized steel. They go together, and it's about a 30-minute job. If you drink beer, it's like a one-beer job to put one together. And they've got them on sale for like $90 for the 2-foot-deep, 4-foot-by-8-foot beds today. They also have the 1-foot-deep beds on sale, and I see, you know, how much of these get bought. I don't see who buys them. But I'll tell you, a lot more of the 2-foot-deep beds have been bought than the 1-foot-deep beds. I think that's because I do 2-foot-deep beds. Guys, I have a rock shoal that I live on with no soil, and I have ducks that eat stuff. If you don't have that, 1 foot of depth in a raised bed is plenty. Save some money, and save money on your fill, too. But check these out again. They're from Vivor, and if you use my discount code, you can get another 5% off the sales price. You can always stack that discount, and anything they sell, you can get an additional 5 points off. That's not just for my members. That's for everybody. You can find the code, the links, everything at tspaz.com. With that, again, thanks, guys, for tuning in. Rest of the week, it's 4th of July. I'm signing off. I'm not even doing a Friday flashback. No, I told the expert council you guys have the week off, so we will be back with you on Monday with a new episode. Until then, oh, and I got an announcement. I reached out to Matt Powers, who is one of the most awesome citizen scientists I've ever met when it comes to regenerative agriculture and soil health. And I said, you know, Matt, over about a 10-year period, you and I took very different approaches to how to come at soil science. I did it by just doing it and working things out and trialing things side by side. I don't even own a microscope. Matt's doing like metagenomic testing. He's got a microscope most of us will never have because we ain't going to spend that damn much money on a microscope. He is full-on science geek nerd, and yet we have ended up practice-wise in almost the exact same place. We're both doing indigenous microorganism as part of our soil rehabilitation. He's doing it with the more conventional IMO that is, you know, part of like Korean and Japanese natural farming. I'm doing it with a different type of like composting and the way that I do, you know, cover crops and things like that. I'm like, why don't we have a discussion? Redneck duck farmer, me, meet science geek and talk about soil health kind of freestyle. And I think that's going to be a hell of a good episode. That will be Tuesday next week. With that, I will sign off and I will catch you later on. Are they going to bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar more.